Call this meeting of the Committee on Energy, Finance, and Policy to order. We have a quorum. Our first item of business is approval of minutes. I may have a motion to approve the minutes for the meeting of February 13th, 2025. Representative Murphy moves approval of the minutes for February 13th, 2025. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Weiner.
There's a vital issue that needs to be addressed here on the minutes from last time. The incorrect spelling of my name.
All right, all right.
Goodness.
That was good. All right, that will be worked on.
I before E.
Thank I you, before, Chair. Except after C. Okay, thank you. All right. All right, those changes will be made. Any other discussion? All right, all in favor with the minutes as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? There we go. They are approved. All right. House File 75, Representative Anderson, if you'd make your way up to the table, please. Thank you. Representative Anderson moves that House File 75 be referred to the General Register. Representative Anderson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members this afternoon on this bitterly cold day here in Minnesota. This bill would do would allow us to at least take a look at and discuss and talk about another possible source of baseload power being able to be utilized as renewable credits in Minnesota's renewable energy system of how we keep track of those things. It removes two lines of statute currently, and all it does is allow that projects larger than 100 megawatts be allowed to be counted toward their renewable energy standards and credits as we go here in Minnesota. And it just seems to me that as we're hearing about data centers and such, that as our demand for electric power in this state and nation looks to be on the increase rather dramatically in some areas where we're hearing, that it would behoove us to at least to be able to look at other sources of power, and in this case, a baseload source of power. And, you know, there are some naysayers that say there are some problems with this type of generation. Well, I would suggest that really there's no perfect source of any source of electric generation. They all have their positives and some negatives, this one as well. But, again, it's clean energy, baseload energy, and it would do us well here in Minnesota to at least be able to look at and study this proposal and allow it to be looked at and possibly used for credits in our renewable energy system. That kind of is what the bill does, Mr. Chair. I think we have a couple of testifiers and then take questions.
All right, thank you, Representative Anderson. We do have a few folks on the list. We have Joe Hoppe with Otter Tail Power. If you'd please come to the testifier table, introduce yourself for the record, and look forward to your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Joe Hoppe with Otter Tail Power. Otter Tail Power Company is one of the smallest investor-owned utilities in the nation. We generate, transmit, and distribute electricity to approximately 134,000 customers in 422 small communities across 70,000 square miles in Minnesota and the Dakotas. Our company is named after the Otter Tail River, which provided our first source of electricity when we became an operating utility in 1909. We operate, I'm not sure if they're all still the same, but we operate five small hydro plants on the Otter Tail River, all near Fergus Falls. They generate a total of a little over 3.5 megawatts. This accounts for about 1% of our total generation. Otter Tail has no current plans for any more hydro, but we do think it would be wise to include it for future plans as all of us utilities try to work our way towards 100% carbon free. With that, I would stand for questions. Thank you.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You say you don't have any plans. Are there things in your territory that would be over 100 megawatts?
Mr. Hoppe.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kraft, no.
Representative Kraft? No. All right. Any follow-ups? Any other questions for the testifier? All right. If you do, we can bring it back to the table, and we can ask Rachel Stuckey to come before the committee. If you want to approach the testifier table, introduce yourself. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Szczesinski and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today and to Representative Anderson for bringing this bill forward. My name is Rachel Stuckey, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Conservative Energy Forum. We advocate for a market-based all-of-the-above approach to energy. As our state works to achieve our goal of having 100% carbon-free electricity by 2040, we need to thoughtfully consider all available options in order to ensure reliability and affordability. Hydroelectric power represents a proven, dependable source of carbon-free baseload generation that can help meet our growing power needs while supporting grid stability, and House File 75 would enable us to better utilize this resource. This bill would permit any hydroelectric facility, regardless of size or operational date, to qualify as a carbon-free technology under state statute. It's important to note that this legislation does not greenlight or permit any specific projects. It simply removes unnecessary restrictions on hydroelectric power as part of our clean energy portfolio. Today, modern hydroelectric facilities of all sizes use advanced technologies to safely generate significant amounts of carbon-free power. Lifting these outdated restrictions would allow for innovations in our power infrastructure, whether building new state-of-the-art facilities or granting existing facilities the ability to upgrade equipment and increase generation. This would provide more carbon-free baseload power to complement intermittent renewable sources, and the expanded capacity would support grid reliability by providing dispatchable generation that can be scaled up when needed. We recognize there are very important considerations regarding impacts to the environment and ecosystem that must be carefully considered with hydroelectric projects, which is why FERC and state agencies have extensive regulatory processes in place. Any new or modified hydroelectric facility would still need to undergo rigorous environmental and socioeconomic review in order to meet all licensing requirements. As we work toward our clean energy future, we should ensure our policies enable rather than restrict proven technologies that can help meet our goals. We encourage the committee to advance House File 75 to unlock additional clean baseload power capacity. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the testifier. I have, two real brief questions. The first is, are you familiar with any projects throughout the state that would be being planned that would go over the existing 100 megawatt limit?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Ms. Stuckey?
Not currently. As the last testifier said, it doesn't seem like there's any current plans, but again, just removing any restrictions for any possible future projects and any restrictions that may act as a deterrent currently.
Thank you.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that. And the second is maybe more of a question to the chair and the bill author in response to a comment made by the testifier, and it's that you are appropriate in stating that there are important environmental impacts that are a result of hydropower. And so I think as we you announced the bill, it was being sent to the General Register. I think because of the really important environmental impacts of hydropower, I think this bill should be going to the Environment Committee. So I would make that request to the bill author and to the chair.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Akam, this bill doesn't deal with any statutes pertaining to environmental law. And in the Senate, that same question was raised, and it was held over and not sent to the Environment Committee in the Senate as well. So we feel that the proper route for this bill is going right to the General Register.
Thank you, Representative Akam.
Brief follow-up, thank you. I will point out that in the Senate, the committee jurisdictions are somewhat different. They have the Energy and the Environment Committee. In the House, we have a different set of jurisdictions. While I appreciate, to your point, that the statutes aren't impacted, the subject area is. So I would just, again, renew my request that this bill be heard by the Environment Committee and maybe change that to a question. Have you spoken to the Environment Chair about this bill?
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I have not, no.
Representative Anderson, would you, if we move this bill forward, would you be willing to, as we said at the General Register, between now and that point, if it needs to be re-referred from the General Register to the Environment Committee, would you speak to the chair of that committee? Would you be willing to send it to there if he so requests? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, yes, by all means, I would.
All right. Representative Akam, does that satisfy your question?
Well, I appreciate the intent, and I would just say that I think that in our committee process, we have opinions by a whole set of voices that sit at this table, and so I strongly encourage a stop in environment.
All right. Representative Anderson, are there any other questions for Representative Anderson? Are there any other testifiers? Anyone from the public that would like to testify on House File 75? All right. Do we have somebody else? Oh, Representative Jones. Sorry, I didn't see you.
Sorry, I was a little, yeah. Anyway, we got it done. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Anderson, for the opportunity to speak on this today. So it's been kind of alluded to a little bit, but you know, every I think I've said this before. Every bill that comes to us, I'm always asking, like, what is the problem that this is trying to solve? And so, if you can just help me again understand, like, what is the issue we're trying to solve? If no utility is currently looking at building a plant here, or of over 100 megawatts, and if it doesn't seem like we even have like the water capacity to potentially do that.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. I think the obvious answer to why no company is contemplating building a facility such as this is they aren't allowed to, or it can't count towards the energy, the mandates and such. So until we would lift this so-called moratorium on large hydro, there's really no point in discussing it. And I would suggest it's much like the nuclear moratorium. There are no plans for any nuclear discussions or plants because we can't right now in Minnesota. So what this bill does, this doesn't say there's going to be a plant, a big dam built in Minnesota next week or next year. It just allows the discussion to continue. And it may encourage a company that if they could use the power produced for the renewable energy goals, that it may encourage one to at least look at it. So that's the reason for this bill, is to allow the discussion to take place and see if it fits in with any power company and their plans to expand baseload power in the state.
Representative Jones, any follow-up? No, all right. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, you said that the nuclear moratorium, that this is very similar, and that nobody's looking at building nuclear because we have a moratorium. And actually, that isn't the case. In several of the long-term utility plans that I've seen, there's been expressed interest in nuclear. And as I look at the hydro and a list of the existing facilities that we have in Minnesota, the largest is in the Minnesota Power Territory, and it's 69 megawatts. And so with that, and the fact that nobody's talking about it or looking at it, this feels to be a solution looking for a problem, in my opinion. And so I would encourage our members to vote no.
Any other questions for the bill author? Representative Anderson, do you have any final comments?
Well, thanks again, Mr. Chair. Just to remind committee members that this allows the discussion to take place, and I would encourage the passage of the bill and allow it to continue on its path, either to the General Register or to the Environment Committee. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would appreciate a positive vote.
All right. Representative Anderson renews his motion that House File 75 be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, nay.
No.
The ayes have it. The motion prevails. And the bill will, House File 75 will be sent to the General Register. So next on our agenda, thank you, members, for your patience. Thank you, members of the public. We have a presentation from the Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, which would be commonly known as MISO. We have Brian Tolow from MISO that will be giving us a presentation. I would encourage members all throughout, so if there is any questions that may come up to your mind as you are hearing the presentation, just feel free. This is a great opportunity to understand the the reason that we live in and how that generation is dispersed. And Mr. Tullo, if you please introduce yourself to the committee and anyone else that you have at the testifying table, and we look forward to a great conversation. Thank you.
All right.
You're on.
Very good.
Just keep her pretty tight, though. I mean, as far as close, it's there you go.
All right. Very good. Well, first of all, thank you very much for the opportunity to come today. My name is Brian Tullo. I'm the Executive Director of External Affairs for MISO's North Region, which basically means that I am responsible for the states of Minnesota, Iowa, North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and the province of Manitoba. Those are the northern part of MISO, and I'll show you a map here in a minute of what that means. I'm joined by Bridget Doctor, who works on my team doing regulatory activities and things like this. So we're always very happy when we get asked to come and explain what MISO is and what MISO does. We work behind the curtain, so to speak, generally, and we're happy with that. But we're also, I think, at an important juncture in our country as far as the need and potential growth of electricity, that we've got some tough choices to make in the years ahead of us. So MISO can help with that, and we've got a unique view on much that we do. So I appreciate you you being here, listening, asking us to come. I'm based in Eagan, where Eagan, Minnesota, where MISO has one of our three regional control centers there. So we've always had one since the beginning. We're about 20 years old. So it's not like we're an old, we've been around for a long time, but we are out there. MISO is independent and politically agnostic. So I'm not here today regarding any legislation, but rather as an information resource to policymakers like yourselves. We often say that we're policy takers, not policymakers. And I view this as a discussion. It's very complicated stuff, but please interrupt me as we go along if I say something that doesn't make sense to me, and I'd be happy to stop and go.
Thanks, John.
Start with a couple pages that just describe what MISO is. MISO stands for Mid-Continent Independent System Operator, which actually doesn't tell you a whole lot, right? Basically, we run the high-voltage electric grid. And we do it on a non-discriminatory for-profit basis. We're independent, not-for-profit, and a member-based organization. So we're responsible for keeping the power flowing across the region reliably and cost-effectively. Our primary objectives are reliability overall and affordability for consumers. Membership in MISO is voluntary, so all of our members, and we've got hundreds of members, most of them are utilities, but they can leave MISO if it's not adding value for them, their operations. So we take that very seriously. That rarely happens that somebody leaves, but it's the important part about MISO is this is an opportunity to group up and just be more efficient as a community rather than operating independently as a separate entity. We have a very open and transparent stakeholder process. We will, on a regular week, we'll have three or four big, open to the public, anybody can dial in, discussion around rule changes and things like that in our process and like that. What do we need to be doing at MISO? So we've got different categories of that, but a lot of stakeholder meetings where it's a very open process. It's a very technical topic, so we don't get a lot of folks just dialing in for the fun of it, but it's good, and we have really good input that we take from folks. I'm not going to go through this all the stats there on the side. I will note that these numbers mean that we're maybe 15 to 20% of the U.S. is how big we are there. And one change that just happened yesterday, the solar peak number, which is shown here as 8 gigawatts, we had a new solar peak yesterday. Yesterday was very cold, but it was also very, very crisp and clear. The air was thin. So we actually hit 10.5 gigawatts of wind as a new MISO record yesterday during that cold spell.
Mr. Tullo, if you'd hold on for one second. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to, you hit the solar peak in the middle of winter?
Yes.
That's pretty cool, huh? Fascinating.
It is. And a lot of that has to do with things that have been added since the last summer, you know, up until now. So there's more capacity on the system.
Right, okay.
So that makes sense, but at that level. Yeah.
Representative Kraft, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Tullo?
Yes. Tullo,
okay. Am I right, though, that solar panels, while you don't have as much hours of sun during the winter, they perform better in the winter, more efficiently, and generate more electricity per panel, let's say, than in the summer. Is that correct?
Tullo.
I believe that to be true, but with the caveat that you just said, it is a shorter time period during the day. But when it's a very clear, cold day, they're very transmissive. Now, that's assuming that there's not snow covering the panels, which can be a problem.
Yeah, shoot. All right. Any follow-up? You're good? Good. All right. Back to your presentation. Thank you.
Okay. So size matters here in this business. Scale is very important because it's what translates into access to numerous members, and that's really a key strength of MISO. We literally sit in the middle of what's called the Eastern Interconnect. So the entire area of the United States, east of the Rocky Mountains, except for Texas, because they do their own thing, except for Texas and including a lot of Colorado, is one big electrically connected grid. It's like we share a heartbeat with the folks that are in New York and Canada and all the way down to Florida. We literally share a clock with the other system operators in our control room so that we're all on exactly the same time with everything we do, because a lot of our job is coordinating with other regions to make sure that if they're having trouble, we can help them out, or if we're having trouble, they can help us out. So a lot of communication that goes beyond, not only beyond Minnesota, but beyond MISO. And frankly, that's one of our big advantages. We're kind of in the middle of the Eastern Interconnect. So we've got 1,000-mile seams on both sides, and we've got other system operators there. And when it's a bad day, we can give help or get help from them, and they're in the same situation. So Minnesota is also a crossroads within MISO even too. So five different states within MISO sort of touch Minnesota. And Minnesota has the benefit of, you know, leaning on those other states when they need to at times, because everybody will have a bad day. Our job at MISO is to make sure that bad day doesn't spread to other places when it does happen. So it's a very collaborative, cooperative sort of mindset that comes into this.
Mr. Tullo, maybe you'd want to just for 1 second maybe explain. So there's Eastern, and then there's two others, I believe, areas. Maybe explain those and maybe the areas that they encompass as well, just for the committee's knowledge.
Sure. Thank you. That's a good question. The Eastern Interconnect is by far the biggest in land mass. Out west, there is a coordinating council, but not a RTO, but it is a separate grid. And by a separate grid, that means that if you're trying to get electricity from the Eastern Interconnect into the west, you'd literally have to convert it from AC, which is what everybody runs on, to DC, which is a different type of electricity, and then back to AC so that they can be synchronized with each other. That's non-trivial. So there is a little bit of ability to import-export between the regions, but that's hard to do and expensive, frankly. Texas is its own special case. They like to do things their way in Texas. Most of my career was spent down there. They are wholly within the state of Texas with their interconnect. Same rules apply. It's hard to import and export outside of Texas. And Texas is the biggest electrical state in the U.S., but even at that, there are times when they've needed help and have not been able to get it because they are actually not not very well connected with either the Eastern Interconnector or Mexico or anyplace else. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think that's
very good. Can we go to the next page? All right, so break down MISO a little bit. Like I mentioned before, three distinct regional control centers. One of them's located right here in Eagan. We have about 120 people there. 24/7, 365 operation. We never go away at any of these control centers. We keep them all alive all the time. Our headquarters and our biggest control center is just north of Indianapolis, Indiana, right in the middle. And we have all of our market functions that happen out of that control center, so it's a little bit bigger. Then down south, we have another twin of what we have in Eagan down in Little Rock and like that. We can operate the entire grid from any one of the three of these control centers, and then there are additional backups beyond that, too. So a lot of redundancy built in. You know, we're really trying to plan for that very worst scenario. Another strength is the diversity, and if we look at the two pie charts that are on this page, you'll see some of that diversity. We've got a very balanced, in my opinion, mix. The chart in the middle, the installed capacity, is the ability to create electricity. It's measured in the gigawatt hours. And then the chart on the right is energy production. In other words, how much energy did you get out of those units that you have? So the percentages look about the same generally, but they're two different measures. One is in the one on the right is in megawatt hours. Again, these are big numbers. This is 15% to 20% of the U.S. in total. Probably the easiest way to understand it, though, is maybe to drill down on one number, and that's the nuclear number. You see that on an installed capacity basis, nuclear is about 7% of the mix of capacity that we have on the grid. But that generates almost 14% of the amount of energy that we have. So nuclear is a very very steady, very constantly on asset. And that's different than the other ones that we have. So what you're looking for is that diversity in the portfolio, and that's a good example of that diversity with an asset like that. So while our scale and diversity across 15 states is a strength, it can also be a challenge because those states often have different and perhaps diverging policy objectives. It's our job to help every state meet whatever their policy objective is. And that's kind of hard to do. That's why we focus first on reliability and affordability, because those two tenets are one thing that I think every state does agree with. They want a reliable grid, and they want it affordable. All right. After that, there's more diversion, different opinions on carbon, things like that. We aren't part of that fight. We just want to make sure that everybody can get, everybody has power, and it gets there as cheaply as possible. Okay, if we can go to the next page, one way to think of MISO is sort of as a air traffic controller, if you would. So the air traffic controller analogy goes like this. Air traffic controllers manage the movement of planes from point A to point B safely and reliably every day. But they don't own the airplanes. They don't own the airport infrastructure or anything like that. They're just there calling balls and strikes. So similarly, MISO operators manage the movement of electricity from where it is generated to the local utilities safely and reliably every hour. MISO doesn't own the generators, the transmission lines, or any part of the electric grid. We don't operate it. We don't own it. You know, it's ours. It's ours to direct after they voluntarily join MISO. MISO is also kind of an auctioneer, too, because the way we decide what power starts next as you're ramping up during the day, say, is through a wholesale market. So we effectively conduct a little bit like a stock exchange would, a wholesale market for electricity. So if you look on our website now, misoenergy.org, you'll see various prices on different parts of our footprint. And that's what that does. We dispatch things and basically conduct a little auction every 5 minutes so that we reset on what's needed to meet the load there and like that. And that auction just happens continuously throughout the day, trying to minimize the cost but meet the load is what that wholesale market does. If we could go to the next page, another sort of cut at this and how we do what we do versus our member utilities work on things. Excuse me. So on the left side of this page, MISO has some activities that they do for the generation and the transmission. On the left, we direct the dispatch of the generation fleet and try to get the most benefits for our members collectively out of those assets. We don't build, own, or operate generators or transmission. And we're heavily FERC regulated. FERC is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, so we're regulated by the federal government. Everything we do is set out on a tariff. Any change we make to that tariff, we have to go to FERC to have them approve that. So it's a lot of a lot to go through, but but it's important. All of our significant rules and procedures go through that review. On the right side, our member utilities tend to do all the distribution, all the end user contacts and things like that. So they're leveraging our stuff, but you know, you ask most homeowners who the RTO is and they're not going to be able to tell you. And that's fine with us. We generally don't want to get between our member utilities and their customer. And that's the way that this has evolved. Was there a question?
Mr. Tullo, yeah, we have one question. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Tullo. So it would be interesting, you talk about member utilities as distribution and end users, but there are some utilities that also are generators.
Yes. Right?
So how does that work with you when you have a utility that does both? And when you say direct, what does direct mean in that case?
Mr. Tullo.
Yes, Representative Kraft. It's I wasn't trying to imply that generation or transmission assets are owned by MISO, because they're not. They just sort of turn over the keys to us and operate based on our orders to start, so that for the good of the whole is how I think about it. But certainly, these utilities are doing the generation work. They're doing the building of the transmission lines, the building of the generators, and things like that. By having them under MISO on this page, I wasn't trying to imply anything different.
Representative Kraft.
Yeah, Mr. Chair. No, Mr. Tullo. No, I wasn't suggesting that. I was just thinking this is an area that would be useful just to clarify, right, just to understand that relationship. So I like how you talked about it. They create the generation, but they turn over the keys to you to start, stop it as is necessary.
Exactly. So every day it's a big auction, and the cheapest goes first. So the cheapest resource out there will be the first thing that gets dispatched. The next thing has a slightly higher cost. There's literally a curve of increasing cost, and we just walk up that curve as demand grows.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate your flexibility here. So on the cost, are you looking at this, that the cost of generating that at that point? You're not looking at other costs. Let's say there may be one form of electricity that generates more air pollution and other costs. You're not looking at that, right? You're looking at just that.
Mr. Tullo.
That's a good question, because we actually don't even look at all the costs for that, but we definitely don't consider those externalities, I would call them. It's purely the marginal cost, the short run marginal cost to generate in the next hour. In other words, what's the price for that? Because that's really the decision. And the cost of that unit to build it, say, it doesn't factor into that at all, because that's a sunk cost. So it's only the short-term marginal costs that affect the order of dispatch.
And just to follow up from the dispatch, you may not consider cost, but do you also consider dispatchability from the quickness in which it can come on? Maybe you want to explain
absolutely.
That a little bit?
Absolutely, because not the units vary a lot in how quickly they can respond to that. So they have a standing bid into this auction that they give us, and they will tell us, "Hey, here's what I can run. Here's what I can run at," but they'll also say, "But I need 30 minutes to start," or better yet, "I need 5 minutes to start." That resource will pop up fast if we have, say, another big unit go down. We need to find a backup for it.
So all right. Okay. Any other quick follow-ups? Are we all good? All right. To your presentation, Mr. Thu.
Very good. Thank you. Why don't we go to the next page? And I'll try to make this a little bit more Minnesota-centric here. So this is similar to the prior page, and we sort of lay out the value chain at the top, where you go from the electricity value chain is going from generation to transmission. Then there's kind of this wholesale market that happens in the transmission phase, and then it steps down to distribution and customers. Those are all these sectors, the independent power producers, the transmission owners, everybody, all the categories listed in the gray box are different stakeholder categories that we have that participate in the MISO process and help us develop the rules to do all this stuff. But all these folks group up and participate in our stakeholder process. So you can see who some of the MISO members by stakeholder sector is. The Minnesota examples that are listed here. This is not an exhaustive list, and it changes all the time. So apologies for anybody who's not listed there. I just wanted a few as examples. But even on top of the folks that are participating at these levels, we have other stakeholder sectors that we also spend a lot of time with. First among those would be the state regulatory sector. So all the states within MISO, 15 states, generally have a public utility commission or a public service commission, and they'll put one person on what's called the Organization of MISO States, which is every state is represented in this Organization of MISO States, where they become a sounding board for us to, as we're thinking about rule changes, game, you know, the way we do things, what are our priorities and things like that. So we get feedback from that Organization of MISO States. It's very important when we do take a rule change to FERC that we have the support of the states. That's the key to getting things done and like that. So they're a very important group to us. You're well represented by Commissioner Sullivan of the Minnesota Public Utility Commission there. And he is actually currently the president of that region-wide group of the Organization of MISO States. So he's serving in that role. And Commissioner Sullivan also asked me to remind you that Minnesota is in the most reliable zone in MISO, which I didn't even know that, so that's good. But he did ask that. But we enjoy working with the folks here in Minnesota. If we could go to the next page, I mentioned the membership in MISO is voluntary. Our members can leave us if we're not adding value. Well, how do we add value? So we actually try to put a number on that every year. In other words, what's the value created by being part of this group and being dispatched together and working together like that? So you can see the drivers at the very top, the benefits from MISO scale, the more efficient use of existing assets, the reduced need for additional assets, and the savings customers can get from that. The big thing here is you just have to, you're sharing reserves basically when you join MISO, and that means if you weren't part of MISO, you would have to have basically 100% of your generation to back yourself up. In other words, if you were, when you're part of a reserve sharing pool, a risk pool like MISO, you can minimize the amount of extra generation that you need on a standby basis. And that is the biggest value driver in all this. Certainly improved reliability is a big one, but these other benefits of not having to build more generation than you need is, you know, that's a direct help to consumers. It lowers consumers' costs. So we've seen about 40, we track this every year, and between 2007 and 2023, we saw about $45 billion in value being created by our estimates. And that's a benefit. So last year was almost $5 billion in benefits at a benefit-to-cost ratio of about 15 to 1. And there's several links here throughout this document that you can find a lot of information like this on our website. So if we could go to the next page, we'll get a little bit more down into more granular, I'll describe it. Because overall, we are facing, I say MISO, all of our members, increasing risk and complexity. That's what's changing now. 10 years ago, after all these utilities grouped up, there was a lot of excess reserves that we've been working off over time. And now we're starting to see some load growth and indications that load growth is happening. So that's come into place. And we've also added a lot more wind and solar to the grid. And that's creating some different challenges for us. We need to operate in a different way. It's not simply just the cost anymore. Availability is you know, very different during the for some of these units. So this is an example of one of our planning scenarios that we look at, but it's based on an actual period that we experienced in January and February of 2020, so about 5 years ago. This is a 60-day period during January and February 2020, and the area that's highlighted there by the red box is roughly 40 hours of period where we had basically no wind on the system. In other words, we always dispatch wind first to the amount that it can generate, but this odd doldrums sort of settled in, and we had zero wind or negative wind at times. I mean, you still have to keep the heat in some of the turbines, but it can go away for extended periods of time like that. So that becomes a planning scenario. Now, this day when this happened, or this couple days, was not a problem on the grid. It happened to be that we had lots of other capacity online and things like that. But in a tight day in the future, we would have to be, you know, we'd have to be concerned about this. The more and more you rely on some of the assets that are just different and have a different profile. So these are the kind of long duration wind droughts that we need to plan for and have stuff to back up for when they happen. Fortunately, they don't happen very often. The next page from a risk standpoint and a current issue standpoint is the load addition story. So we're all reading about all the interest in data centers and things like that across every state. And it feels like every state is competing with each other to get the data center, to get the jobs, to get the investment, things like that. So there's a bit of a frenzy there right now. Load growth is not something that we're used to, frankly. Basically, and this chart on the left is system peak load during these months here that are shown from 2007 to 2023. Basically, it's been flat. There's not a big trend there. And a lot of that, I think, is more energy efficiency and things like that coming in. So a lot of the investments that have been made have helped us keep that fairly flat, that demand, because there's certainly been more people, more jobs, more economic activity that's covered by that demand. But now we're in a different era, and we're seeing for the first time big spot loads wanting to come onto the grid, data centers that are just on a completely different scale than what we normally see, where load is added incrementally, and it's added in the places where you already or close to the places where you already have load and generation, like in an area like the Twin Cities, it would be closer there. These can be farther away. They can be out in the middle of nowhere at times where the grid is thin, and that has implications and things like that. So it's a very challenging problem. It's a great opportunity for those communities and the states and the revenues and the jobs and everything like that, economic development, we get that. But it needs to have some guardrails on it.
Mr. Tullo, just that's an interesting subject matter when you're bringing that up, you know, just because your perspective, obviously, as we as legislators, we're kind of Minnesota focused, so to speak, and we're kind of dealing with that issue as it continues to emerge. From a MISO perspective, what would you say is that number throughout your territory that you're looking at. So we've got numbers of maybe 10 or 11 or 12 potential investments here in Minnesota. What's, you know, so if you look at Wisconsin, obviously there's some being built that's much further along. Same as with Indiana and Michigan. Kind of what are you seeing throughout the rest of the other states when it comes to some of those conversations and how that's going about as far as total capacity?
Yeah, it's more similar than it is different, frankly. I mean, this discussion's happening in every state. Some states are asking, is it going to be worth, and this is the right question to ask, is the economic development benefit going to be worth it? Are these data centers going to be allowed onto the grid in a way that doesn't cause costs to consumers? So that's, and every state has a different process for going through that. But from my perspective, that's the key, is making sure that, customers aren't affected, that the timing doesn't get out of whack with how quickly that load is added versus how quickly the transmission and the new generation can also be added. Mm-hmm. You need the generation before you can add the load. which means generation is going to have to move faster than it's ever moved, mm-hmm. and transmission will have to move faster than it's ever moved to make some of that happen. So I think it's definitely a trend. How quickly that happens will, I think be constrained a little bit by the speed at which the electricity grid can be upgraded.
Certainly. What feeds them is going to be the potential first issue, obviously. Obviously, some of the conversations that we've had is those are 24/7, 365 organisms, essentially. What percentage, so when we're looking at, you know, the peaking and your ability to run the grid, what kind of industry are you able to shut off? So I know we've had conversations with, like, Northern Metals that are, if you're at a peak demand, that they might get a phone call and they're told to shut down production. Like, what percentage of that peaking is not just generally generation, but actually production shut down, where you're trying to get rid of load, as far as the role of MISO when it comes to that, if you'd maybe explain that a bit?
Yes. We have a whole category of resources that are available to shut down or dial down. They don't shut down all the way necessarily. How much capacity they're using. Utilities may have even plans like that for homeowners and things like that, because there is value in having an ability to reduce reduce demand reduction. We've got some assets like that. These data centers tend not to come in like that. From what I've seen, generally, they want to be on 24/7, and they don't want an interruption. And they may even add some backup generation to make sure that they don't. We would like that stuff to be on the grid. And if they had even a little bit of flexibility on the load side, that would help a lot. Because what we're planning around is events that are very rare. They don't happen a lot. But they will happen, and if there's not enough electricity, somebody's going to have to be lowered. If the loads don't reduce demand, then that comes back to MISO, where we could actually get into what's called a load shed event. And fortunately, knock on wood, we have not had one of those broadly across our grid, but they have happened. The reason there are RTOs today is because there was a big one that happened in 2003 and blacked out New York City for 3 days.
Mr. Tuller, Representative Akam, you have another question?
I do. Thank you. And thank you for the presentation. This has been very interesting. You just hit on a point that caught my attention, and that was about that you would like to see data center backup generation on the grid. Mm-hmm. We had a presentation on Representative Mecklen's bill. What day is today? Was that last week? I'm losing tracks. of days, yeah, last week. And it was their hope in that particular case that the backup generation was not on the grid, if I recall. And so I'm wondering, within the MISO region and in other states, are there examples of both those data centers that are connected to the grid and those data centers that are not?
Yes.
Mr. Tullo.
Yes, thank you. Yes, the answer is all of that. And it varies a little bit by whether the type of RTO and the type of regulation that you have in that market. In the eastern markets, Pennsylvania and the like, there are more what we call merchant generation, where the generators are not connected to load, versus here where we have mainly vertically integrated, rate-regulated, traditional utility rate-making. Very different outcomes there, because in a rate-making utility, the fixed costs for a lot of those assets are run through rates. In a merchant environment, they're just sort of individual actors that can kind of do whatever they want to do, or whatever the economics sort of drive them to do, but they may not be on. So I don't know if that answers your question, but.
Representative Akam, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It does, in a sense, just that this is a topic that maybe needs further discussion. And I think that as data centers are looking to make plans in Minnesota, I think that this particular issue is an important one to at least have conversation about. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Mr. Tullo, back here. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Why don't we go on to the next page? It's about done with our journey here. So I've talked about some of the challenges there. What this page does, tries to do is lay out what are we trying to do about those challenges that we face. And for the last 3 or 4 years, we've been working with something called our reliability imperative that breaks down what we need to do to meet these challenges. It's broken down into four pillars: market redefinition, which is more how do we adjust our markets to handle this new round of things? I won't get into the details of each of these. It's pretty weedy. Operations of the future: how are things going to change in our control room? The folks that are there 24/7, you're talking about artificial intelligence, things like that, voice activated everything. So a lot of risk assessment and uncertainty management sort of tools in our control rooms. Transmission evolution is all about the transmission grid that's needed to support all this. Very important and a very long lead time item. And then system enhancements are more on the IT side of things, and cybersecurity protection and things like that. I'd say between a third and a half of the people that work at MISO are what I would call an IT professional, because keeping these markets running, keeping all the tech that has to keep things going and protecting it from a cybersecurity standpoint is a full-time job for about half of MISO, and it's quite a challenge to keep up with those systems. So instead of talking about any one of these, I just wanted to take one thing and sort of drill down on it a little bit. If you look at the transmission evolution bucket, the first one there is our long-range transmission planning, and the next page is one example of that. So since we don't have time to talk about all those, I just wanted to pick one that I thought was relevant. So one of the roles that we play that's not in the real-time time horizon or the market's time horizon is this very long-term perspective that we have to take from a transmission planning standpoint, because MISO is a regional transmission operator as well, an RTO. And part of that means we should plan for the big regional transmission lines. Now, the utilities are still individually doing their own local smaller lines, but the idea here is trying to pick up the big backbone transmission lines that are needed as generation moves around, as population moves around, as demand shifts and like that. And frankly, there's no way for any one utility to do this. They have to group up together, and MISO becomes that, and that's part of our thing. MISO did its first portfolio of these types of projects in 2013. That was the first time anything like this has happened anywhere in the country back in 2013. The last of those 2013 lines are just now being energized. It's taken that long to get all of them through the process and on board. In about 4 years ago, we started this new tranche of transmission planning, tranche one, if you would. We know this won't be the we knew this wouldn't be all that's needed because we're actually working on tranche 2.1 now. But the first portfolio of projects, and these do come to our board as a portfolio of projects, not individual lines like most lines come. But since they affect multiple states, our board of directors has to approve them based on a cost-benefit analysis and things like that. And then the lines go into the state process. So that was a big tranche that was approved. About $10 billion worth of transmission build back in 2022. We have just completed and our board approved in December the next tranche of lines, which is an expansion even of this. And that has about a $20 billion price tag, which is it's a lot of money, but there is still a very strong benefits case because we have to do the math and the economics on this to make sure that expense like that makes sense. And the benefits case for these projects is going to be in the 2 to 3 range. In other words, the benefits are double the cost, which is a real strong case.
Representative Jones, you have a question.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I have just a clarification question because you were mentioning earlier that the members own the generation and own the lines, but then in the tranche one, you're talking about how the MISO board is making an approval for an expense. Can you help me understand? Whose money is being spent, and then who owns what?
Mr. Tallot.
Very good. Thank you for the question. It really doesn't change anything in the state process because these, after they're approved by MISO, they still have to go through all the state process they would otherwise have to do. So it's still the utilities that are assigned the lines, building the lines, and even after they've got MISO approval, they have to then now go to their states and say, this is how we'd like to do it. This is the particular routing that we'd like to take. Because when we draw maps like and develop these things, we're just going point to point. A straight line between point A and point B is generally not how they will actually go. There's a community discussion that needs to happen. There's a lot of things that go into the siting that needs to be adjusted, and our member companies will still have to go through that, just like they would if it was a local project that they were doing. So nothing really changes. It's just an added layer on top to help get that regional, interregional view.
Representative Jones, follow-up.
Yeah, if I may, Mr. Chair, Mr. Tallot, just to make sure I understand this, so you're saying, okay, we're joint putting a line from point A to point B and say that line actually crosses multiple utilities. So you're saying, I think you used the word assign. So if we're seeing that there's a need to create a bunch of transmission, it's basically assigned to the utilities between point A and point B to kind of figure out what that routing should be. And then those utilities would be on the hook, I guess, responsible to pay for it. Is that correct?
Yes. Mr. Tallot.
Yes, that is correct. Think of it like this. Say a project was going to go from an Xcel substation to a Great River Energy substation, right? And that's what we define. It's a 100-mile line. Typically, those two entities would then kind of get together and work on that line because it's the ownership at the endpoints that determines sort of who it would be assigned to. In that case, it's both. So they say, okay, we'll get together, we'll build this line together, and that's an efficient way of doing it.
Representative Jones, Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in talking about kind of this long-range transmission planning and that, this planning for Tranche 1 started back in 2013, And I think we're seeing a lot of federal frozen funds that are happening as a result of our new presidential administration. And so wondering if you can maybe highlight impacts on tranche two, or if there are any even residual impacts from leftover from tranche one that might be impacted due to frozen federal funds.
Mr. Tolo.
Thank you. That's a good question. I'm not aware of any. There are some interregional projects that had gotten the DOE grant that we're working with our neighbors to the west, Southwest Power Pool, where there was several, about $400 million, I think, of federal grant money, matching money, that would have lowered the cost for consumers. That's being actually led, the administrator there is actually the Minnesota Department of Commerce. So thanks to them for that, which is you know, it's very complex to do anything like that. So we really appreciate that. But it is, you know, that's probably the biggest question I have as I look out as far as how the federal changes are going to impact some of this stuff, is whether that grant money, which really is going to lower customers' bills, if it comes through, still comes through.
Yeah. Representative Akam, do you have a follow-up to that?
I don't. Thank you very
Representative
much.
Representative Weiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a reference to reliability, and I'm going to go back a few pages, and I apologize. But you had 40 hours of essentially zero wind, and that was an issue. So now I believe now in Germany they've had about 4 months of a wind drought, which has decreased 20-25%.
Yeah. Representative Weiner, would you point your mic up to your face and make sure your switch is on? It's a little difficult to hear. Thank you.
I apologize,
if you want to just
Mr.
restate
Chair,
your question,
usually
that'd be
great. I'm loud enough. So. But so Germany has had a wind drought for the last 4 months, I believe. Now, have we seen anything close to that in the MISO grid? And then also, another question, because when we talk about reliability, the forest fires that we saw in Canada, especially last year or a number of years ago, how does that affect, and do we see a noticeable decrease in the solar when we have the murky effects from the forest fires?
Mr. Tolo.
Okay. Let me start with Germany. I have heard about wind droughts there. First of all, Germany as a market is much, much smaller than ours. They don't have the reach and the spread to kind of get, you know, wind from other regions, if you would. You know, it's a very, very small space. We've got this big footprint that things can come in. So it's different wind patterns are covered there. So I don't think we'd ever have that. I mean, it's actually well known in the industry that, in fact, Germans coined the phrase Dunkelflaut, I think, which means kind of a wind doldrum. And they do have a problem with that. What that means is they have to lean on their neighbors, you know, within the European community a little bit more. So we haven't seen that extensively within the MISO region yet. But it's still, even at 40 hours, that's a problem if the grid is tight already. So we don't rely on it maybe as much as we otherwise would with a different sort of asset. Forest fires in Canada, absolutely. We've seen some degradation around solar when those happen. Fascinating studies when we had the eclipse, too, how that affected solar, things like that. Basically, it went to zero when we had the eclipse. So, yeah, anything like that makes the emissivity lessened is gonna hurt.
Representative Weiner, do you have a follow-up to that?
Sure. The other question I guess I have then is demand changes, and that was discussed just briefly. So with the increase of extra energy going to the potential data centers in Minnesota, but if they don't end up in Minnesota and end up still on the MISO grid, do you find that it's the demand for electricity is going to be an easier obstacle obstacle to overcome than regulations, or is it the other way around?
Mr. Tillow.
Do you mean environmental regulations? Could you restate the question again? I
guess Representative Weiner, why don't you just kind of make that a little simpler for us?
Sure. When the demand goes up, whether it's in Minnesota or Iowa or Wisconsin or wherever, the demand is going to go up. Do you find that easier to meet the demand in a state with less regulations?
Mr. Tillow, that's probably not your wheelhouse as a nonpartisan regulator, but maybe if you'd like to take a crack at it, otherwise I'm... But,
yeah, I'd rather not. I mean... especially given the opportunity. No, I mean, every state is different. And every state has a different perspective on the trade-off between economic development and affordability. So those are elected officials in those states, or appointed officials in some cases. Our job is to take their collective wisdom and try to make the best the best stew we can out of it.
Well, I think you, Mr. Tillow, you could have just answered that with your first statement. I think that you made. You said you're policy takers, not makers,
right?
And so you take what you're given, and you're trying to deal with it the best you possibly can. So, do you have a follow-up, Representative Weiner? Are you good to go? All right, Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you again, Mr. Tillow. So we were talking about transmission a few slides ago. That made me start to think about interconnection, and you know, because transmission connects things, and it's like, well, we also have generators that are trying to get into the grid. And I've heard that there's quite a backlog in the MISO territory. So I'm curious about that. And has MISO considered switching to connect or manage our system similar to what they're doing in ERCOT? Because I understand that their backlog is much less if they even have one in ERCOT.
Mr. Tillow.
Yes, we spend quite a bit of time on you're referring to our generation interconnection queue. And just for everybody's background a little bit, before you can connect to the grid, you have to apply to MISO, in this case, as the grid operator, to understand what sort of network upgrades you're going to cause when you put a wind farm or you put a gas plant or whatever, wherever, because it's going to have impacts on the transmission system. I mean, you don't want to have something built that can generate power, but it can't get it out. From there. So it's a process for assigning network upgrades that are driven by new generators in generally remote locations. And we've had a flood of interest in building that stuff out, so much so that you really can't, it's hard to even study that scope of generators. I mean, it's at a time there were 300 gigawatts in the system, I believe. So that's more than we have online already. Mm-hmm. So, you know, good news is people want to come in, developers want to come in and build something, but it's hard to do that without things like the transmission upgrades that I talked about, the Tranche 1 portfolio, the Tranche 2.1 portfolio. A lot of those will unlock a lot of that generation that wants to connect to the grid. So we're at a point now where we've used up what we've had out there, and that's why we need to add more transmission so that those projects can actually get put in place.
Okay. And to Representative Jones, you know, I think one of the issues that we looked at over the last 2 years was the city of Northfield. There was a kind of a real small level. I think there was a lot of folks that had wanted to have capacity on their own property, so rooftop solar. And one of the big issues was that the substation by itself couldn't handle that increased load because it was potentially on a small level, you know, at capacity. And so then the question becomes not only that you have people that would like to make an investment and sell, but then who actually has to pay for their ability to sell that power. And so that was the conversation that was had, and I forget exactly what happened. I think the original bill, I think it was Representative Purcell's bill, was to give $10 million to upgrade that. I forget if it was where the money came from, but essentially, you know, who then, you know, if it's, it, you know, if you got a product, you also have to get it there. Who pays the shipping? Is it the people that want to sell it, or is it the people that want to buy it, or is it the taxpayer? And so that's, you know, ultimately this conversation is it rattles around these halls is where do we send that dollar, and who's going to pay for it? So do you have a follow-up, Representative Jones?
Yes. Yeah, no, this discussion is really helpful. I'm kind of curious, so how does what we're doing here differ from, like, ERCOT?
Hello. Thank you for that question, too, because most of my career was spent in ERCOT. And they first of all, it's in a single state RTO like that, you can do a lot of things differently. ERCOT in Texas basically reports directly to the state legislature and the governor there. So there's no grouping of states. It's one thing. So they can get something done pretty quick and change things fairly rapidly. They've got a build it and they will come approach because they've got a unique area in West Texas that has a lot of very good wind power, very good solar power, and there's not many people, and the people that are there have gotten used to leasing mineral rights to oil companies to drill for oil. So giving their land, which isn't very high value land, it's dry scrub brush that hardly run cattle on it, they're really happy to have somebody come in and put a wind turbine like that. So you don't see the landowner angst in West Texas that you do in almost every place else in the country. So to enable that, they said, well, go ahead and build the generation, and then we as a state will organize the transmission to go build it or to go connect it in and add to that. And that's how they built their transmission, basically going from the open areas in the west of Texas to the populated areas in the east.
Awesome.
Representative Jones?
Yeah, one more follow-up. Sorry. I find this really fascinating. thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Tillo. So if they have the more approach of if they build it, if we build it, they will come. If we know, for example, in Minnesota where our best solar and wind resources are, you know, our utilities and MISO could work together to start building those transmission lines in preparation for those resources. Is that correct?
Mr. Tillo.
That's basically known. There's so many people in the queue, though, that it's hard to say, is it five people looking at the same spot, or is it really five distinct, you know, projects located in a different way. What we saw was a great confluence of folks jumping in when we did this first portfolio, the tranche one. So folks are going now to those endpoints that are locked out, and they're wanting, some are, you know, have gotten out of the queue and are coming back in based on some of those locations. So there's a lot of interest there. So I think all of that will happen. Some have said that a lot of that capacity has already been, you know, tried to or accounted for or taken up by those projects. So there's great interest. The best way to enable that is to build get more transmission built.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Chair. Sorry, I was distracted looking through the slides. Thank you so much for the presentation. It's been really interesting. I feel like I'm learning a lot. My question is based on an article that I had read previously about uneconomic coal plants being run before cheaper resources. So there was an article that came out last year, it looks like it was July, that said that the running of coal in MISO costs ratepayers $1 billion. And so, you know, as a legislator who has to represent people on this grid, and I need to take care of my ratepayers, I'm curious about how often that's happening and what we can do to try to change that. Because if we're running uneconomic coal, you know, it's not only the cost of the ratepayers through the energy costs, because it's more expensive than renewable energy, but also the health costs that are borne out for the people in the state of Minnesota. And you know, we pick up that tab too a lot of the time. So I'd love to hear your answer on that.
Mr. Tolo.
Yes, we don't run an uneconomic dispatch. It's economic dispatch. and we do have to consider the different start times and minimum run times and things like that for the units. So states have looked at some of the bidding patterns of utilities and have made changes, reporting things, which is mainly what the Minnesota did. So I think we're seeing less and less of that based on that scrutiny. But there's not, it's not like MISO is trying to encourage that. You know, we're looking at just lowest cost and trying to dispatch the next lowest cost unit. And at certain prices, you know, those units are still very viable, but they tend not to turn off and turn on very quickly. So a lot of that is minimum run times.
Well, Mr. Tolo, would it be right in the fact that it's not only just affordability, but also from a reliability standpoint? So if you have a particular day where wind would probably be a chief, if you could rely on it, you would do it. But, you know, you're looking at weather patterns and you're saying, well, we've got some wind gusts coming in and we're expecting kind of a downgrade in at 45 minutes, which that wind resource will be there, but it's not going to be as reliable as it would if you could. I mean, you look at steady wind power for a day, and you could predict roughly where you're going to be at, you know, intermixing need, want, capacity, load, and then weather patterns and expected wind power throughout the day, essentially. Right. Representative Hollins, follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess I understand what you're saying, and I appreciate that commentary also. I would just hope that as we look to the future, we try to examine what is most economical, not only in the short term, but also in the long term, mm-hmm. For the people in the states that MISO represents, or, you know, the states that are a part of MISO, I guess I should say, or the utilities that are a part of it. And also, you know, I think that's one of the benefits of being in this multi-state system, this, you know, that we are not just looking at the wind gusts that come through Minnesota, right? But we're also looking at the Dakotas, and we're looking at, you know, different places that hopefully, because we are a part of this larger grid, we're not Texas. Mm-hmm. Thank you. that we are able to not just look at, like, you know, one spot, but also just think about, you know, holistically how we can do that most effectively.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. the grid is always something that we worry about with the reliability. To your point, Mr. Turlo, what is our exposure to, like, EMPs or you know, security hacking? How much do you put into that side of the grid and how we're going to be protected?
Mr. Tolo.
Again, a good question. I referred it a little bit when I was talking about the number of folks that we have that are working on cybersecurity issues. We used to report the number of cyber security attacks that we had fended off every month. We've even stopped doing that because that was just information getting out that was maybe helpful. So we are, you'll have to trust me on this one because I can't get into a lot of the details on what we're actually doing there.
Okay.
But it is a huge focus area for us, and we've been pretty successful so far at keeping bad actors out. The idea of a EMP is something that's been out there for a long time. That would be a bad day. That would be hard to defend against. So, yeah, we're concerned about that. We're concerned about natural EMPs, geomagnetic, I call them burps, out of the sun. And you get this geomagnetic wave that can affect what, you know, basically the electricity grid is a big receiver for stuff like that. So when you get a magnetic wave coming out of the sun, it can have an effect. Hmm. We watch that. We use the Space Weather Center to help us predict that, and we'll actually declare conservative operations or something like that if we see one of those coming. And generally, we do see them coming because we've studied the sun activity enough that we can do that. Now, an attack is something different because you don't necessarily see it coming. But we would handle it the same way. We would try to lean on our diversity and try to get those areas of the country, of the footprint or the country that weren't affected, to help out the ones that were impacted the most.
I think Representative Baker, if you look up the Carrington event, that would probably be the most enlightening when it comes to kind of the solar flare and what the impact that had just on the telegraph system and what that did to a pretty rigid system. And I don't even think we want to think about today if that something like that would happen. We'd it'd be a different bit of bills that we'd be hearing if that was the case. So, you have a follow-up at all, Representative Baker? All right, Representative Sexton.
Good afternoon, Chair. I have two questions, if I could. First question is, how often does MISO sell back and forth outside, sell and buy electricity outside of MISO, just to give us an idea? Either transmission is limiting you or generation is limiting you, such that you have to buy from somebody else. That is the first question.
Mr. Tillow.
Yes, Representative Sexton, that good question. Almost every minute we're buying and selling, you know, with somebody outside of MISO. A lot of those imports or exports into MISO are economic-based. In other words, if power is cheaper in Pennsylvania, then we're going to pick that and have it imported into MISO, and a generator that's in MISO at a higher price won't run. So that economic dispatch happens at that level, and won't purposefully chooses the imports, and that may flip during the day. You may be importing some hours and then exporting in other hours. I've been watching that on our website, and this is a good chance for maybe a plug for MISOEnergy.org, because we do have a website out there, and there is all sorts of fascinating stuff that you can watch. You can watch in real time kind of what's happening. Excuse me, how much are we importing from Manitoba, or how much are we importing from the east? How much are we importing or exporting to other regions? And that happens every day, and it sometimes changes in the middle of the day. So we're always trying to minimize the cost so that those lowest cost units run, even if that lowest cost unit is not in MISO.
Representative Sexton, your second question.
Second question. I do use your app quite a bit. it combines the cost per megawatt hour of electricity. Do you have a general breakdown as far as what coal costs, what natural gas, solar, wind? I mean, obviously, we want to use the renewables first, but if they're more expensive in your economic base, how does that break out? And maybe you don't have it at your fingertips, maybe you can get back to us.
Mr. Tillow.
It's not the total cost of the unit that we're looking at. We're only concerned with the marginal cost of the unit. So a solar panel that's built has basically zero marginal cost. So that's always going to get dispatched first. The units that have a higher marginal cost are the ones that are going to be dispatched last. Those tend to be fast start units that maybe aren't very efficient, but they can get there right away. If we need it, we'll work our way up in the stack for that. So it's not really a we only consider that marginal cost. We don't look at how much was spent to build the plant, because that's just not relevant to the economic decision.
Mr. Sexton, your third question.
I guess then, do you have any idea what coal is costing us per megawatt versus natural gas? Because my understanding is, working with our public utility within my area, you give them a forecast when you want them to bring on their diesel, usually about 24 hours in advance. So they've got a good idea they're going to be running or not running.
Yeah.
So you are forecasting this out more than just a five-minute response. So I'm just curious
how
that works with your economic decisions.
Right.
Mr. Tillow.
We do look at that, but again, it's back to the marginal cost of the units at the time, and if you were to ask me, like the economics of a coal unit, the marginal economics change as well. So I would say generally, coal has a, it really all depends on the price of natural gas, because natural gas tends to be the swing determinant. So if natural gas prices are high, the coal unit's going to win. If natural gas prices are low, the gas unit is going to win the debate. So it really boils down to what's happening in the minute and where. And you can have pockets that have very expensive natural gas, so that's not going to run much. And it depends on the pipeline system and what's going on the pipeline system.
Representative Sexton? Follow up?
I guess more of a discussion, Mr. Chair, but I'm still trying to, I'm not intentionally trying to put you on the spot, but I think you're telling me that coal and natural gas are driving most of your economic decisions in your forecast for the day?
It tends to be the marginal fuel. Because the things that are way in the money on a marginal cost basis, the renewables, wind, solar, nuclear actually runs ahead of all that stuff, because although it costs a lot of money to build a nuclear plant, it's maybe $20, $30 a megawatt to use it. So nuclear gets dispatched early on, and then it's just a matter of where are the commodity prices on those other two types that are competing for the price setting unit. Because remember, it's the intersection of supply and demand that sets the price. So as the cost of supply walks up that curve, price goes up.
Just a reminder, members, we have about 17 and a half minutes left, but I'm not counting. Representative Igo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Tullo, for being here today. And thank you to my colleague, Representative Sexton. You kind of teed me up here. I wanted to talk about your website and your app where you can look after. And I think maybe we need to open up our rules for committee, because every member of Energy Committee should have the MISO app on their phone. Because we should be checking that every day to give a better understanding of where things are at. It's very intuitive and actually gives good perspective to the conversation we're having today. And I think the conversation you guys were just having has actually teased me up perfectly the question I wanted to ask. When we're talking about supply and demand and how we're making those decisions, I kind of wanted to see how other forms of energy factor into how MISO could be more affordable and have be more dynamic. And I just wanted to know, like, would expansion of other types of energy be important to this conversation, particularly around nuclear energy?
Mr. Tullo.
We never met a form of electricity generation that we didn't like. I think it would all be good. And as I mentioned around nuclear early on, it's got one of the highest capacity factors. It truly is what we would call baseload electricity, and it runs very reliably and cheap. There are other ancillary things with nuclear waste and things like that that people have issues with, but when it comes to competing in our markets, they're the foundation generally as we set up every day on how we're going to get through that day. It's the nukes that are right on the foundation, so it's very important.
Well, Representative Igo, too, if you look back at page 3, if you look at the installed capacity of that pie graph, nuclear is 7%, and then energy production from a nuclear standpoint is 14.
Yeah.
And, you know, my question to Tullo as the follow-up would be, how often do you curtail nuclear?
Never.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it goes down maybe one unit will go down every 18 months generally for
maintenance.
Fuel cycle. To put new fuel in the reactor, and it'll be down for 30 to 60 days, and that's well known and well planned in advance, so we can handle it. But once it comes back up, it's generally right there. Now, not every nuclear plant has as good of uptime as others. So that comes into play.
Representative Vigo, anything else?
No, thank you, Chair Swazinski. That was, like I said, that was kind of the point I was getting at there, to identify, you know, where is our best baseload. And when we talk about making sure we have an affordable and reliable grid, I think that can really kind of outline where we're going. So thanks for the alley-oop assist there, Chair Swazinski.
Yes. All right. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Telos, I'm interested a little bit, a couple lines of questioning. Congestion costs. Mm-hmm. I know they can be significant in the few billions of dollars spread across the MISO grid. So what are they now? How do they impact rates? And then I think ways of addressing those in the short, obviously transmission is a significant way of addressing those, but what is your position on encouraging things like grid enhancing technologies, reconductoring, virtual power plants, all ways of addressing these congestion costs that don't require additional transmission, and how does MISO think about them and encouraging them? So congestion costs, give us a sense of them, and then on these ways of addressing those.
Mr. Tolo.
Yes, thank you for the question. Grid enhancing technologies are a good thing. We hope our members look at them. Again, we don't own the transmission system, we just use it. So there, it's, you know, we're not going to go out and hang Getz gear, you know, so MISO can use on their system. So it's really up to the local utilities that own the lines, that if that makes sense for them to put that in. It would improve the visibility for us. Some have, some haven't. I think they know their systems really well. So I think they've already gathered all the low-hanging fruit when it comes to opportunities for that, generally. But that doesn't mean, you know, we shouldn't keep looking for it. But it's not something that MISO can do unilaterally on top of what the utilities can do themselves.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tello, what about virtual power plants? Because this is an area where in some markets, aggregators can bring these to MISO to offset load. So what are your thoughts on virtual power plants and how those might help?
Mr. Tolo.
Thank you for that. Boy, this is a well-informed crowd, because these are really good questions. Virtual power plants are basically, I put them in the category of demand response. Instead of actually generating power, you're reducing the demand, and that kind of creates a power plant in its simplest form. Now, you can have batteries connected to that and other things to move it around a little bit. But it's all good. I mean, it's helpful. I think the economics will drive how quickly it plays out. Because it's generally on the distribution side of the system, it's not something that we always see, because we don't see past the distribution level. In other words, we know the feeders maybe decline, but we don't know why. So it's not really something that we can dispatch yet, like we can other units that are on the high voltage side of the meter.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tello, I want to thank you. This has been really informative, and I really appreciate the presentation and the back and forth. Sincerely, really helpful. I just want to close by a couple of comments. I think your focus is right on, right, how you're focused on safety and reliability and your marginal cost approach. And the amazing thing about marginal cost in renewables, it ties back to that zero fuel cost. It does some pretty amazing things once you have them in place, and that there is no cost, you know, there's virtually no cost to use them when they're there. I want to reflect, Representative Wiener made a comment about the forest fires and smoke drifting in from them and obscuring solar panels. By the way, the other things that it does is it really dramatically hurts air quality, and people need to stay inside. And this is where I love MISO's focus, but as policymakers, we need to take into account broader costs, not just that marginal cost, but the cost to society of the decisions that we make and how we generate power. And that is why, you know, the things that Representative Wiener brought up, I think, is a enforcement for how important our 2040 law is, so that we not just take into account the marginal costs, which is what you should do, but we take into account the broader costs to society. So thank you for your presentation.
Certainly.
Representative Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Tillo. I'm sorry, I've had so many questions, but this has been so fascinating. Quick question around these tranches. So this tranche one was approved in 2022. It seems to be coming every decade or so. When can we expect the next tranche of transmission lines?
Tranche one was in 2022.
Mr. Tillo.
Yes, thank you. Representative Sexton. Tranche one was in 2022. We've already approved tranche 2.1. Oh. That was approved just 2 months ago in December by our board of directors, and that is out there on our website as well. Tranche one, it's about twice the size of tranche one. Same area of the country. Noticeably, it's proposing to add in something we don't have in our system today, which is a higher voltage class of 765 lines. And you see a little bit of this into in other parts of the country, where you're really trying to get the most throughput for the smallest footprint, because that the siting is really a big limiting factor in a lot of this. For example, one corridor of 765 kV lines will you can fit that in one corridor is equivalent to three different corridors of our current highest voltage class, which is 345. And we know when these lines are built, there will be a siting fight. There always is, and a routing fight. But these lines are so important. What we try to do is utilize existing right-of-way where it exists, and if anything, you know, upsize it in this way so that we're not adding new corridor that will create more. So those sorts of considerations go into developing the transmission plans and how we would upgrade that.
Representative Jones?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tillo, another question. This is kind of going back to something I believe it was Mr. Representative Baker had brought up around, or maybe it was Mr. Representative Anderson, around solar flares and, or actually more around just our security of our grid. And you had brought up needing to, you know, looking at, you know, the security, depends or is affected by, like outside actors, but also weather. And you had mentioned solar flares as being one of those things and your reliance on the Space Weather Prediction Center. So that's under NOAA, and, you know, the Trump-Musk administration is has proposed cuts to that. And so I'm wondering if that has if you're seeing any potential impacts there to your work.
Mr. Tillo.
Thank you. We haven't seen any changes yet. I wouldn't be the first one within MISO to notice that, so I can look for it, and I'll reach out if we do see anything. But I imagine, you know, it's been so recent that that's happened, that hopefully they don't get rid of the Space Weather Center, because that would be a big problem.
Mm-hmm. Representative Jones, anything else?
Final question.
Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Tillo. Going back to the conversation around the generation queue, so the interconnection. Mm-hmm. So my understanding is that there are many projects in the generation queue that are not, you know, part of member utilities. And so that given that MISO is made up of utilities, I'm just curious, how do you avoid like the conflicts of interest that might kind of exist there?
Mr. Tillo.
Just to clarify, what sort of conflicts of interest versus
Representative Jones?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Tillo. So if we have a project that's coming from a non-member utility, it's yeah. You know, it's its own generator, and they're trying to get a project in the queue, But MISO, you know, the decision makers are utilities. You could see where like that could be a point of tension. And so I guess how do you work through that tension and still get at the mission of, you know, affordability and reliability and making sure it's not putting utility projects before other projects?
Mr. Tullo, maybe would you like me to answer that one, or you want to?
I would welcome the help. Thank you.
All right. Well, you know, I think Representative Jones, I think the difference would be is from a regulatory agency. MISO is not a regulatory agency. It would be the PUC that would probably be making those decisions when it comes to, from a generation standpoint, capacity standpoint, and a contributor standpoint, which would be the independent generators. And so where MISO steps in is after those decisions have been made from a PUC standpoint, then they're dealing with that capacity issue and how the routing is. And while on number 11, we did talk about transmission, they're talking about the big stuff, not the interconnection stuff from that after this stuff is built. So.
Wonderful. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Tullo. I wasn't trying to put you on the spot there, but really similar to Representative Kraft, really appreciated this conversation. It's been really enlightening.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Akam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also want to just sincerely thank you for the conversation and really appreciate the approach of the conversational way that this happened today. I think it really was helpful to many of us. So thank you. And one of my favorite takeaways of the day is that Minnesota is the most reliable in MISO. So thank you.
Great. Well, and I have to say, I appreciate the kudos for the MISO website. So just remember, Google MISOEnergy.org. Because if you just Google MISO, you just get a bunch of Japanese soup recipes.
Mr. Tullo, would you repeat that? I missed that. Would you
sure.
What's that again?
The website is MISOEnergy.org.
All right. We'll be thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate the information that you brought before the committee. Sure. I'm sure there'll be a couple of bill drafts that are going to Mr. Eloff here because of the conversation today. So with that, we'll be meeting on Thursday, and we'll be hearing a bill or two on that day. And until that point in time, we are adjourned.